honey, be for the, be for the honey, be for the. This is KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM. I'm Deanna Riley. This is the Hive Poetry Collective. And today I'm here with Greg Shapiro, poet from Florida. Greg is the author of 8 books, including the collection Fear of Muses that just came out this year in 2022 from Souvenir Spoon Books. His poetry appears in The Pen Review, Exquisite Pandemic, RFD, Gargoyle, Limp Wrist, Molly House, Impossible Archetype, and a variety of other journals. He also appears in the anthologies Moving Images, Poems Inspired by Film, and This is What America Looks Like. Also, he appears in Sweeter Voices Still, an LGBT anthology from Middle America. He is an entertainment journalist whose interviews and reviews run a variety of regional LGBTQ and mainstream publications and websites. Shapiro lives in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with his husband, Rick, and their dog, Coco. So welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Dion. Thanks for inviting me.
This is one of the wonderful things about Zoom that we learned about in the pandemic, that we can be interviewing people from all over the country. But this is a Zoom interview, and I, as always, am on a ranch. So if you hear a bull running through my living room.
Wow. I thought we had cool wildlife down here in South Florida, but...
So if we hear a crocodile, or no, an alligator, right?
Yes, no alligators, but we have, gosh, we have a variety of lizards, and we have parrots and peacocks and ibis and egrets. And
do you have manatees?
I've not seen a manatee. That's one of my goals before the year's up. I decided I have to see, because they're so beautiful and gentle, and I want to see one. So
they're like a
I know where to go to look, but I haven't yet.
They're like a unicorn or something like that. They're just like...
Right. They're hard to see, but there's a certain time of year where you can see them more than others. And so I'm working on it.
Okay. So that's your upcoming project.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being here on the Hive Poetry Collective.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm very grateful.
Well, we... always like to begin these interviews, or frequently begin interviews, by asking the poet to read a poem that inspires them. And you picked The Skokie Theater by Ed Hirsch. Why did you pick this one, just briefly before we begin?
Sure.
Or is there anything we need to know about the poem before we begin? Just any opening remarks?
Well, place is very, very important in my work. Always has been in my fiction and in my poetry. And so I'm often looking for place poems. And this has a special meaning to me because I was born in Chicago, but I grew up in Skokie. And I've actually been to the Skokie Theater that he writes about. So that's why I chose the poem.
Where is Skokie?
Skokie is... one suburb north of Chicago.
Oh.
So it's just north and a little bit west of Chicago. So like directly north of Chicago is Evanston, where Northwestern University is. And so just a little bit west of both at that border there is where Skokie is.
That's such a great name, Skokie. What kind of a name?
It's a Native American name.
Oh,
so
you know what it means?
I don't know what it means.
Huh, okay. Well, why don't you just, that's okay. So it's about place and that's all we need to know. You want to just jump right in and read it to us then?
Sure. It's from Ed's book, Wild Gratitude. The Skokie Theater. 12 years old and lovesick, bumbling and terrified for the first time in my life, but strangely hopeful too and stunned, definitely stunned. I wanted to cry. I almost started to sob when Chris Klein actually touched me, oh God, below the belt in the back row of the Skokie Theater. Our knees bumped helplessly. Our mouths were glued together like flypaper. Our lips were grinding in a hysterical grimace while the most handsome man in the world twitched his hips on the flickering screen and the girls began to scream in the dark. I didn't know one thing about the body yet, about the deep foam filling my bones, but I wanted to cry out in desolation when she touched me again, when the lights flooded on in the crowded theater and the other kids started to file into the narrow aisles, into a lobby of faded purple splendor, into the last Saturday in August before she moved away. I never wanted to move again, but suddenly we were being lifted toward the sidewalk in a crush of bodies, blinking, shy, unprepared for the ringing familiar voices and the harsh glare of sunlight, the brightness of an afternoon that left us gripping each other's hands, trembling and changed.
Thank you, Greg Shapiro. That was The Skokie Theater by Ed Hirsch. Oh my gosh. So much I could say about this. But you know, the ending, just the ending, hands trembling and changed. You know, there's just sort of this tradition of so many poems that end with change.
Mm-hmm.
From the Rilke, I must change my life, or you must change your life, or something like that, to so many, to Tony Hoagland's infamous poem that ends, and we were changed.
Well, and in a way too, it's almost as if the poet wants to change the reader in the process. I think that's part of it. I think you can be changed, maybe in a small way, by a poem. And so I think, you know, we all hope for, especially now, some signs of change, something.
I know that Kim Rosen has a book I've never read, but many people love, called Saved by a Poem, which is sort of
a
similar idea. Yeah,
it's interesting. I did an interview with a singer-songwriter named Mary Gaucher. And last year she had a memoir published called Saved by a Song.
Mm.
And it's sort of a memoir of just about her own, how music changed her and saved her. And how it's almost like a how-to as well, because it's sort of got, you know, instructions about songwriting. Beautiful book. So yeah, so we there are ways to be saved, I think.
Yeah, so that's sort of a larger issue that we jumped into right away about the uses of the lyric, the uses of poetry. I think it's Gregory. I was reading a book by Gregory Orr, and he says, there's no time in written human history that you can go back to that you don't find lyrics.
Right.
You know,
absolutely.
Sappho, way before Sappho. Even it's just, you know, like we're like birds, we just like have to sing. So this is a beautiful song. I just love at the beginning how he keeps telling us how the speaker feels, and he keeps adjusting it. Lovesick, okay, we get that. Then then bumbling, and then hopeful, and then stunned. Definitely stunned. And then he wants to cry. So he changes it again. And you know, when I first read this, I wasn't sure if this was going to be like a heteronormative thing or if it was a guy that he was with.
And right, because the name Chris could be male or female.
And then the most handsome man in the world is twitching his hips on the stage. So it's not till, you know, I think over halfway through when she touched me again.
Right.
And we know that it's a woman. So.
But I'm guessing from his age, he was probably watching an Elvis movie.
That's what I was thinking, that it was Elvis. Yeah. Right. Like Jailhouse Rock or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. One of those bad movies. Yes.
That are so good. Yeah. And then, you know, he doesn't have very many similes in this, except for he says that they're glued like flypaper, which is kind of gross.
Nice.
Yeah. Kind of gross. But then he says, I didn't know yet one thing about the body, which of course is hyperbole because he must know something, but still we love that hyperbole there, about the deep foam filling my bones.
Beautiful. And the fact that the person in the poem is 12 years old too. I mean, there's just so much more ahead, right? So it's just, it is about learning about your body and learning things for sure.
Yeah. So, and then they walk out into the last Saturday in August, which is such a time of change.
Definitely. Summer's over, school's going to start. And if you're in the Chicago area, you have nothing but cold and gray and bare trees to look forward to for, you know, 7 months. So it's great. Really good.
Oh my God. So it's this last bright moment. So, okay, wonderful poem to start with. And yes, so set into place. And then the first one we're going to read by you is about Denise Duhamel. and it's Gemini Sister. By the way, I'm a Gemini. so are you?
Yes, I'm happy. I'm a proud Gemini as well.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so I want to back up just by saying that Denise and I went to college together in Boston. That's when I first met her. So she's been a part of my life for a very long time.
Well, maybe we should just tell our audience a little, you want to just tell us a little bit about Denise Duhamel? She happens to be one of my favorite writers. I discovered her early in my poetry career, and she really made me feel like I could write in my own voice, my own damn voice. Do you want to just maybe just tell us a little bit about?
Well, I mean, she's pop culture, feminism, she sort of brings it all together beautifully, seamlessly. I'm going to see her tomorrow, so I'm going to be sure and tell her that I'm saying all these things about her. Really inspiring, a great teacher as well. I've been a guest speaker in her class, and I've seen her with her students, and there's a lot of good there, a lot of good. So I hope this poem does her well.
If anyone wants to read a great poetry collection about divorce.
Oh, yeah.
Blowout, okay.
Yeah, phenomenal.
I really love that one. It's so, she just says things about her ex that, like, wow, you really have some ovaries to say that out loud. Okay, so anyway, Greg Shapiro, why don't you go ahead and read Gemini Sister here at the Hive Poetry Collective at KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM.
Gemini Sister for Denise Duhamel. No matter where you live, you will always be Boston to me. That party at the North End apartment I shared with John, the most unforgettable soiree at your Brookline flat, the one where Byron handcuffed Michelle to the refrigerator, the Pretenders concert at the Orpheum, and thrift store shopping on Washington Street and at the Morgan Memorial in the South End. When I came to visit you in Tucson, you put a brave face on it, but it wasn't meant to be your home. You were much better suited to the Lower East Side. It was the mid-1980s and so dangerous. Adrenaline, your preferred perfume, pink as the neon poet sign in your window and warm in blue fake fur. I envied you every second of your poetic life there. You put in your time and earned that fabulous place on 23rd Street, down the block from the Chelsea Hotel, and a short walk to the Cowgirl Hall of Fame. Not even Lewisburg, Pennsylvania could dull your luster. Your reward was to return to New York take up residence on Spring Street in Little Italy, not far from the Puck Building. I appreciated the bathroom with the clawfoot tub and sink at one end and the WC in the living room, although it gave Rick pause. Astoria, with its elevated trains and active Greek community, couldn't contain you, so you packed it up and headed to Hollywood. Florida, that is. Swimming pools and ocean views. Do you think it has anything to do with us being Geminis, this urge for going, for collecting addresses like stamps or coins, our names in the address books of friends and acquaintances, a blur of whiteout, erasure, and scoring through? I think it's what makes us such lovers of hot weather and sunshine, so quick to dismiss cold and sunless climates. And what good fortune we have to share the refuge of poetry, the safety of stanzas and the economy of expression, wrestling with language for the sake of an indelible image, mapping uncharted paths to transform popular culture, mythology, feminism, religion, family and love, rhythmic as two hearts beating in time.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's from Fear of Muses.
That's right, from Greg Shapiro's new book, Fear of Muses. Check it out. I'm sure it's available everywhere you get your books.
It is, bookshop.org. Mr. Bezos's business. Also at spoonbooks.com, which is the Souvenir Spoon Books website.
And of course at our local bookshop, Santa Cruz, if you're here in the Central Coast. And Two Birds Books on 41st. Free advertising here on the Hive. Well, once again, I just noticed that this poem does end with change. Mapping uncharted paths to transform popular culture.
Right, transformation.
Yeah, it does end with that. I just want to read my favorite line in this.
Okay.
It was the mid-1980s and so dangerous. Adrenaline, your preferred perfume, pink as the neon poet sign in your window and warm in blue fake fur. I envied you every second. Line break of your poetic life here. I like that line break. And I really
did have she had a bright pink neon sign in her window in the East Village that said poet.
Putting it out there. I mean, owning it.
Absolutely.
Like, I didn't call myself an artist or anything like that until I was like in my 40s. I couldn't, it was too terrifying to admit to such a thing. I love that there's a party where Byron handcuffed Michelle to the refrigerator.
Yeah, it was such a weird time. It was Boston in the early 1980s, and wow, it was just a different world. At the time that we were at Emerson, I mean, now, the other night, I'm not even kidding, the other night, on Jeopardy, Emerson was an answer to a Jeopardy question. Emerson College.
The college.
Emerson College, yeah. So I texted all these people I knew, all these friends, and called people. And so, but at the time, I mean, Emerson, it took a few years after we graduated for Emerson to really become this, it's much better known now. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the time it was, it was a great place. I made some lifelong friends there.
Well, there's such a shortage of colleges now. I was a high school teacher, and a lot of my students wanted to go to Emerson, just these small private colleges. There's just a limited number of them, and it's really, they become more and more desirable. It's like houses. It's like housing.
Yeah, true.
They have a hot shot journal that comes out of Emerson, don't they?
Plowshares.
Oh, right. Plowshares.
Done. Yeah. In fact, before Plowshares was a part of Emerson, it was an individual. It was in Watertown, Massachusetts, which is close to Cambridge, just across the Charles River from Boston. And I did an internship at Plowshares. And it was amazing. And I was reading back in the day, this is pre-submittable, pre-email. So everything was, you know, mailed to magazines with your Sazy and the whole thing. And we were reading poems for an issue that Seamus Heaney was going to be editing. And a poem actually that I passed on to the regular editor there before it went to Seamus actually made it into the issue. So I was very happy about that. But we were the first readers, the interns were the first readers.
Mm, such great experience. Did you learn a lot from that?
Oh, it was, I'll never ever forget it. And one day the phone rang and I had to answer the phone and it was Raymond Carver calling. It was sort of those kinds of things, yeah.
I really love his poetry. Well, what kind of things did you learn? Like, what did you begin to look for in poetry?
Well, one of the things I certainly learned as somebody who was beginning the process of submitting work to magazines is that there were boxes, stacked on boxes of submissions under this table. So, as I said, we were the first readers. So it really made me understand that process of, you know, this is why it takes 3, 6 months, maybe a year back then to hear from a literary magazine. So I learned to be more respectful of that. I learned that people didn't really do the research before sending work to Plowshares. You have to do the research. You have to familiarize yourself with the journal that you're submitting to. And so as hard as it was to, you know, pass things on as rejected, it just showed me again that it's good to know the publication that you're submitting to before you send.
Do you still read Plowshares?
I do. It's amazing that they were able to merge with Emerson. And yes, I mean, it's got a long history. It's one of the most well-respected literary publications in the U.S. So
you feel like the magazine's changed a great deal?
Well, I think all literary magazines have evolved over the years. And again, I think it also has a lot to do with the fact that there are so many new voices and younger writers. And so that's the trick. And I think that they do a nice job of balancing established and new voices. That's an important thing.
Well, getting back to your poem, Gemini Sisters, I noticed that you write in several of these poems that we're reading today, it's almost like they're very long lines. They're very long, prosy lines. And it's not a prose poem because you have line breaks, but you do favor a kind of a prosy style. Is there a particular reason for that?
Believe it or not, I think this goes way back to, again, to when I was first doing this. I was discouraged by a writing professor who, thankfully, I don't remember who it was, from writing short lines, that there was this idea that a short, you have to earn a short line. That in order to like do this, it really has to pay off. And I think it scared me in a way. And I just thought, okay. So, I mean, I'm just like flipping through and I mean, there are definitely some with shorter lines, but yes, the longer line, plus I also really like playing with enjambment a lot. And I think that the longer line gave me, at least, made me feel more comfortable playing with enjambment.
Do you want to just refresh our reader's memory on what enjambment is?
So enjambment is when a line ends without punctuation, so, you know, so that your eye continues to the next line in the poem.
I think
it's a kind of a pause.
I think in French it means leg over.
Wow, that's perfect.
Yeah, so it's just kind of a leg over the fence into the next field,
right?
I guess you'd say. Huh, that's interesting. It's funny how they what people say to us about our poems or our bodies or anything just sticks in your head. And
right, right. Well, the shortest poem in the book, which is dedicated to Bill Knott, I really feel like I owe my publishing career to Bill Knott, because when he was teaching at Emerson, in the poetry workshop, he asked us to all send our work out. He liked the work, the quality of work in the workshop so much that he actually said, you know, in order to pass this class, I'll teach you how to do this. I'll teach you how to send work out. And it was because of him that I got published as an undergraduate, not in a school literary magazine, but in a literary magazine, you know, in Chicago, a regular literary journal. So I owe him quite a debt.
Which poem was dedicated to Bill Knott?
The poem is the poem poem after Bill Knott.
Is that one that we're reading today?
I don't think so. It's on page 20. It's 5 lines long. Very, very short.
Why don't you read it real quick?
Okay. Poem after Bill Knott, 1940-2014. The only response to bringing your terminally ill dog to the vet to be put down is to lie down next to it, roll over, and play dead. And it was a poem that he had written about, I think the line is, the only response to a child's grave. And his is also very, very short.
Oh yeah, I've read that poem. Well, it's amazing all the different things that a teacher can teach you.
Right.
It really is.
Right. The influence is, you know, take it or leave it, but it can be very long lasting.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and read Outside In.
Okay.
So let me just say that this is KSQD Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM, KSQD.org. I'm Deanna Riley, and this is the Hive Poetry Collective. And today I'm talking with Greg Shapiro, who's reading his poems today from Fear of Muses, his newest book, available anywhere you get your books. And now Greg's going to read us another poem.
Outside In. Kate Bush knew what she was talking about when she sang, "Outside gets inside through her skin." Just ask the mirror while your body, not your friend, never your friend, begins its systematic betrayal. First, the eyebrows, formerly arched without plucking or maintenance, now wiry and erratic, capable of injuring innocent victims during unwelcome embraces, potential stunning weapons, flesh stretched beyond elasticity, uncooperative and mutinous, sets about its shaming mission. People laugh good-naturedly when you tell them that you undress in the dark, but you are serious as a lesion. But really, what does it matter if you can't see a reflection anyway? Fuzzy, cloudy, smeared, muted, lightless, and focusless. If you were a camera, you'd be stored in the back of the bottom drawer of a questionable, rusty, and creaky file cabinet, along with the dead motor Walkman, the leaky souvenir mug, bent wire hangers, dusties, ashes, unsent RSVP cards and corresponding stamped envelopes, an ancient wooden mousetrap, stained overalls, and the slinky that wouldn't. Fill a dollar store toolbox with safety pins and aspirin, pliers and gauze, brightly colored electrical tape and earplugs, a glass bottle of India ink and the president's hairpiece, tailor's chalk and expired condoms. Pour yourself a steaming cup of hot herbal tea with a side of sympathy. If you recall, George Michael told us he preferred it Outside.
That was Greg Shapiro reading Outside In. You like to use a lot of pop icons in in your writing. And I recently had someone tell me that I shouldn't, and I kind of feel like pushing back on that. I really like that. It kind of stabilizes the poem in a certain way, anchors it. It anchors it in time and place. It's like a literary illusion. And you're funny when the way you're talking about the eyebrows, like they're gonna, let's see. Just ask the mirror why your body, not your friend, never your friend, begins its systematic betrayal. First the eyebrows, formerly arched without plucking or maintenance, now wiry and erratic, capable of injuring innocent victims during unwelcome embraces, potential stunning weapons.
Yeah, it's...
I looked at my husband the other day and I'm like, honey, give me your pocket knife. We need to do a little trimming here.
Yes, it's a strange, you know, I don't have any hair here, but I certainly have plenty coming out of here and here and places that just shouldn't be. And even the hair that's here, you know, the eyebrows, that was just... Because I used to be proud of my eyebrows. Well, I mean, that's kind of a gay man thing. I was very proud of them. You know,
well, now they're just women are into their eyebrows. I've never.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I was a redhead, so I never had it.
Oh, wow. Oh, yes. There you go.
But you know, it's just this larger question of, just the shame about bodies, you know? I was reading this book about the late, or the 1800s, when there were people that were kind of bicultural. They could live with American Indians or they could live in European society for whatever reason. They had grown up in both. And those people, without exception, would always choose to live in the American Indian society. I mean, without, you know, they would give a gap on running water and all that stuff. And I really, honest to God, I think it's like just imagining living without shame about who you are.
Absolutely. Yes. It's, and again, I think that is also being a gay man, body image, all of this stuff is, body dysmorphia is a huge problem in the gay community. So yes, it's something that I've long been aware of. So I tried to lighten it up a little bit, make a joke about it. But there's also some seriousness there.
Yeah, I mean, this simile that you have in here, flesh stretched beyond elasticity, flesh stretched, nice sounds. Flesh stretched beyond elasticity, uncooperative and mutinous, sets about its shaming mission. People laugh good-naturedly when you tell them that you undress in the dark, but you are serious as a lesion. Serious as a lesion, but great sounds there. Mutinous, undress, flesh stretched, mutinous, serious, undress, lesion. All these words are really resonant with each other. So what is it that you see in the gay community regarding these kinds of dysmorphic issues? And what do you think it comes from?
Well, I mean, we see just these people who are obsessed with, you know, it's one thing to go to the gym for fitness, for health, but a lot of it is just building your body to a point where, I mean, it's about being beautiful, about being young. Although there's also, living here in South Florida, there's a lot of older gay men who also fall into this, where they just, you know, they're at the gym all the time. They're getting sort of facial work done. This is not uncommon at all down here. And I think some of that also spilled over into the straight community for a while, there was that metrosexual term where it was like straight guys, you know, very confusing to gay men, because they would see a man that looked gay because he was very well put together and well-dressed and in shape, and they weren't. But I think that also that dysmorphia has also transferred to the straight male community too.
It's like cultural appropriation in the worst.
Absolutely. And women, my God, for years, women have had that issue, and the fact that it really did spill over into men is just, it's not healthy for anybody, basically.
Yeah, it's like, hey guys, welcome to the club.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it just comes from capitalism.
Well, someone's making some money off of it. I mean, you think about like the Peloton people, right? There's just this, it's just amazing. And down here in Florida, because you can wear sort of more, like in Chicago, you've got all winter to put on as much weight as you want because you're covered in down jackets and sweaters. Down here, it's kind of spring and summer all year round. So your body's more exposed, and you definitely see a lot of that and down here. So,
well, I think that's one way as poets, you know, you can kind of make a difference. You can talk about when this begins.
Right.
Can you remember the moment when it began for you, when you first looked at your body and went, I'm not good enough, or I'm ashamed?
Oh, well, I had an eating disorder when I was younger. So yes, I was very much, even though I was rail thin, I had eating issues because I didn't think I was, back then, you know, there was a period there when being really thin was okay. But then of course everything changed during the AIDS crisis, because there was wasting. And I think that also was a response to that in a lot of ways. This body stuff was like, well, you don't want to look emaciated. You don't want to look really thin. And I think that also ties into the gym behavior. So yes, body issues have been with me for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Have you written about that a lot?
I have, actually, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, good, because that takes a lot of courage, doesn't it?
Well, it's, again, if I can help somebody and, you know, if they get something out of the poem, or if they want to talk, I'm happy to share my experience.
Well, let's move on from our bodies. Into,
okay.
yeah, I write about that a bit too. That's one of my topics for writing. It's shame, you know, the roots of shame, just like kind of decolonizing ourselves.
Right, right.
It's really what it comes down
to. You know, it's about self-love, right? You just have to love yourself however you look. That's the secret.
Yeah, you know, people think it's so hard to lose weight and be in shape, but you know what? It's a lot harder to love yourself.
That's the truth. Very true.
That's the challenge. Okay, so let's move on to School for Scandal. And I was so happy to see this, because I just started watching for the first time Desperate Housewives. Like, I had no idea that that was actually a good show.
Very good. And she was actually one of the better actresses in it.
She's amazing.
Yes, yeah. She really is.
I have this low opinion of her from the school scandal thing. But you know what? You always have to look behind the headlines. Just take it all with a grain of salt, right? Yeah. You just never know.
There's a great movie called Transamerica, where she was nominated for an Oscar probably about more than 10 years ago. That's, I really recommend it. It's a phenomenal performance. So this is the School for Scandal. Felicity Huffman was robbed. Felicity Huffman broke the law. Felicity Huffman is the mother of two daughters. Felicity Huffman got time. Felicity Huffman is running out of time. Felicity Huffman was sentenced to less time for her crime than someone without white privilege. Felicity Huffman is usually blonde, but recently went brunette in a Netflix movie playing the mother of a gay son who forgot her on Mother's Day. Felicity Huffman is a meme. Felicity is defined as the state of being happy, especially in a high degree, bliss. Felicity Huffman doesn't look happy. Felicity Huffman is acting. Felicity Huffman is an actress. Felicity Huffman is the hawk I saw standing on a pigeon in the post office parking lot, talons bloody, gray, and white feathers scattered across the black, damp blacktop like autumn leaves. Or is Felicity Huffman the pigeon?
That was Greg Shapiro reading from his book, Fear of Muses. That was School for Scandal. This is the Hive Poetry Collective on KSQD Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM, KSQD.org. You know what? I love this ending when you kind of flip it. Is she the victim?
Right.
Or is she the predator? And that turn also, Felicity Huffman is the hawk. And it's great because she is hawk-like. Like she looks like a hawk.
Yes.
Felicity Huffman is the hawk I saw standing on a pigeon in the post office parking lot, talons bloody, gray, and white feathers scattered across the damp blacktop like autumn leaves. Or is Felicity Huffman the pigeon? You know what this kind of reminds me of? It reminds me of how everyone made fun of Britney Spears. And then you get this retrospective documentary and you get a whole different look on it. And I think that maybe it's the millennials that are really coming of age and kind of rewriting history a little bit and looking back on it and being really critical.
And well, and I think it's tied into the whole cancel culture thing that, you know, that these people are sort of just immediately, you know, removed from, and again, not that they haven't all done something wrong, but I think people might just be too quick to judge. And I think that's what I was trying to get to with this, was that, and it was really inspired by seeing this hawk and this pigeon. And when I saw that, and then somehow there must have been something on the news about Felicity Huffman, and it just all came together in that way. But yes, I mean, there was a thing the other day on the news that Kevin Spacey is back in a movie and people are just flipping out. And, you know, did he do his time? Did he do enough time? Was his career sidelined long enough? It's just hard to, and this whole thing too with Dave Chappelle, it's a whole series, the comedian Dave Chappelle, who's just vehemently anti-trans and is constantly putting these things in his show. And, you know, it's all about backlashes. I live in South Florida where the governor is taking revenge on the Walt Disney Company because they supported their gay employees. It's crazy.
There's no anonymity anymore. Like you can't just have your little beliefs and keep them to yourself. It's everyone knows about them and everyone's reacting.
Well, and I'm sure that's social media has such a big part to play in that. And in a way too, the 24-hour news cycle. I mean, there was a point in our lives, well, depending on how old you are, when the news, the TV actually turned off. There was like a little dot and the TV went off the air. They played the national anthem and there was no more TV. You actually had to go to sleep or read a book or something. And so anyway, that's.
Well, poetry is really nice because if poetry is didactic or kind of binary, or if it's cliched or one-sided, it's a bad poem. I mean, this poem is good because it's kind of ironic because you're using subject verb, just regular sentences all the way through. I think every single sentence is a complete sentence except for the last one, which is a question, or is Felicity Huffman the pigeon, which you could say that is a sentence. It does have a subject and verb. It just begins with a conjunction. But so you've got this very matter of fact style in the syntax, but what you're really doing is raising the complexity of the situation and forefronting that.
Right. And it's sort of, there's a, it's almost like a chant also, where it's this, in a way, it's, I was going to mention this before with Outside In. Outside, another thing I love are list poems. I love lists. And Outside In is a huge list poem. And this, in a way, is a list. It's a litany of these things that are, these are, that are all connected, but they're, but it's like I said, like a chant.
Yeah, it has that anaphora, Felicity Huffman is, Felicity Huffman is, except for the last line is, or is Felicity Huffman the pigeon. That's sort of like where you put in the little hook of, well, you think you know her, but do you really?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you do bring in this thing of Felicity Huffman was sentenced to less time for a crime than someone without white privilege, where you kind of read that and go, oh.
Just the facts, you know?
Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. Okay. Okay. Yeah, you know, another thing that this is like this is right now there's this trial with Johnny Depp's, I guess, ex-wife or girlfriend or something. And I'm really, I am not paying attention.
Neither am I.
I am looking in this. I'm looking at this and going, we'll find out what really happened in 15 years.
Right.
Right now, everyone's jumping all over everyone else and being angry, and we'll sort it all out later.
Right. It's just ugly. It really is. It's one of the uglier pop culture things occurring right now, and it's just horrible.
Okay, well, I think we have time for at least one more poem here.
Okay.
Maybe we've got Disco Dolly here, and maybe we'll just be able to run through one more after that without talking about it. But let's go to Disco Dolly.
Disco Dolly. Of course, it's bright pink vinyl. That's not shocking. What other color could it possibly be? The purple label with her signature and the irresistible invitation to dance with Dolly at your own private Studio 54. The RCA logo makes me dizzy, delirious as it spins on the turntable, and I spin around, dancing to the song as I have for more than 40 years. I have blazed many miles, left burn marks on clothing and furniture in cities, smoky trails like Dolly's Great Smoky Mountains near Pigeon Forge, where we made a pilgrimage to pay homage to her. Sure, we were disappointed there was no D Cups ride, but how many people can say they got stuck on a malfunctioning log flume at Dollywood? The first of two such events in one summer. Baby, I'm burning, always playing in my head like a broken record, but that 12-inch single never broke. Carefully packed and transported, it transported me everywhere I lived, in every romantic relationship, a hymn to him and him and him, heating up the coldest winters, the sweatiest summers in Boston and Washington, D.C., and Chicago and Fort Lauderdale, surviving the disco demolition and the AIDS crisis, drowning out the Bible-beating protesters that surprised me, Denise, Julie, and Angie outside the BB&T Center before the concert. Once inside, we felt safe, wrapped in Dolly's grace, her voice more powerful than prayer, extinguishing the flames of hatred.
That was Disco Dolly, read by Greg Shapiro. It's from his newest book, Fear of Muses. This is KSQD Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM. This is the Hive Poetry Collective, and I'm Deanna Riley. Disco Dolly. okay. they don't have a D Cups ride, do they?
No, I was, you know, just,
okay.
But you know, like the teacups in Disney.
I know.
Yeah. Okay. I just thought, yes, it was okay. Just a little joke at her expense.
Okay, all right. Just I was pretty sure. I just love the diction, the sounds of "Baby, I'm Burning," always playing in my head like a broken record, but that 12-inch single never broke. Carefully packed and transported, it transported me everywhere I lived, in every romantic relationship. A hymn to him and him and him. I want to go a little bit further. Heating up the coldest winters, the sweatiest summers in Boston and Washington, D.C. and Chicago and Fort Lauderdale. Just some really great sounds there. And so I'm assuming that there were people protesting at a Dolly concert?
Yes, that's something you would see down here more than you'd see up north. It was actually Denise Duhamel, Julie Marie Wade, and Julie's wife, Angie. We all went to this concert a few years ago, and there were, well, I think it's because of her embrace of the gay community. She'd been very open of her about her support and love for the gay community. And there they were with their crazy signs, the religious protesters. So
I would have thought that Dolly's charisma and her sort of red state creds.
Well, yeah, and her own religious, she's a very religious person. So they really seemed so out of place. And there were maybe only 6 or 7 of them, but it was enough to just be unsettling. But, once again, Saint Dolly brought us back to reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a record that's actually bright pink. She has a bright pink record.
It is. I'm going to see if I, give me a second. I'm going to see if I can snag it here.
So I can take a look at it.
Yes. I think bright. Definitely see it.
Okay. And this is a new record or an old one?
No. It's from the late 70s.
Wow. She has always been so cool. Dance with Dolly.
Okay. Here we go. I got it. Okay. So this was the 12-inch single and...
Okay, so for our radio audience, it is just, it's like Pepto-Bismol pink with a purple label in the middle. So it's gorgeous. Let me see the cover of the record.
Oh,
and the cover of the record.
So this was is how they used to package 12-inch disco singles. It would have like the... You can see the label like in the middle of the thing.
Yeah, so there's a hole in the middle of the album cover so you can see the label. And hold it up again. Let me look at it. And she has got the big white wig and then she's got the pink dress with the big lace, low shoulders and the lace over the bosom and showing a lot of leg with some silver shoes. It's
the
just,
silver mules, yes.
Silver mules, yeah. Just very, very Dolly. I mean, she looks
And this was her one late 70s when everybody was jumping on the disco bandwagon. This was her song, and it's from, I think it's from her Heartbreaker album.
So that crackling you hear right now is the album. Is the record going back into the record?
Oh, sorry.
Oh, that's all right. Thanks for showing us that. It's just a gory. Is that worth anything? Is that worth a lot of money?
Yes. Yes.
I'd pay $1,000 for it.
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a collector of stuff, so that's part of the collection.
Well, it's gorgeous.
Thank you.
So, Dolly. Well, what are your current projects? What are you working on these days?
Well, my main thing is my day job is I'm an entertainment journalist, so that's just taking up a lot of good time, doing a lot of interviews. I do a weekly movie review column, do a recorded music column of recorded music. That takes up all my time. I think it's possible that one of the next projects will be a combination of the three books that make up this trilogy from Souvenir Spoon, which is, the first book was Greg Shapiro's 77. The second book was more poems about buildings and food. And the third is Fear of Music. And the thing that these all have in common is these are all, the titles are all homages to Talking Heads albums. So Greg Shapiro 77, that was actually Talking Heads 77. The Talking Heads album, more songs about buildings and food, became more poems about buildings and food. And then the last one, Fear of Muses, was Fear of Music became Fear of Muses.
You know, I was going, there's something familiar here. What is this? Okay, that's fabulous. So you're going to put them together in like.
I think that the next project is to put them together all under one cover.
Maybe call it The Name of the Poet is Greg Shapiro.
Well, that's really, we were going with something with, because the fourth album is Remain in Light.
Oh yeah.
So there's a poem where there's a reference, a new poem that would be included that sort of makes reference to that. So that's probably the next thing in the works.
Well, that's a beautiful name. Well, yes. We have come to the end of our decap ride. So thank you so much for coming on to The Hive.
I'm so grateful, Dion. Thank you so much. This has been amazing. Thank you.
We loved having you here. So this has been The Hive Poetry Collective. I've been talking with Greg Shapiro. His book is Fear of Muses. Check it out. This is KSVB Santa Cruz 90.7 FM. Thanks for tuning in.